Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. With summer camps for pre-K through high school, offering skills in sports, music, and more. luther.edu/summer-camps.
Support for WPR comes from Stafford Rosenbaum, a Wisconsin-based law firm celebrating 145 years of commitment to practical legal solutions in areas such as family law and estate planning. staffordlaw.com.
From the plots of his Milwaukee urban farm to low-income communities across America, Will Allen has shown us a new type of heroism. Through the Good Food Revolution, Allen recounts his effort to reclaim his family's heritage, and in doing so, confronts lingering disparities in racial and economic justice. As the champion of a new and promising movement, Will Allen is skillfully leading Americans to face one of our greatest domestic issues, our health. Those are the words of former President Bill Clinton about our guest today, Will Allen. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Why would a man with a career in professional basketball and then in business walk away from corporate life to grow vegetables in a deserted lot a half mile away from Milwaukee's largest public housing project? Why did the MacArthur Foundation award Will Allen, the son of sharecroppers, a genius grant for his work in urban gardening? How does the organization Growing Power bring together urban and rural communities to target racism, create jobs, and improve health? Joining us to discuss his life and his belief in work in food justice is Will Allen, CEO of Growing Power, and the author, along with Charles Wilson, of The Good Food Revolution, Growing Healthy Food, People, and Communities.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Well, it's great to be here this afternoon.
Well, we're going to range pretty broadly, I can tell. It's not just about food. It's about all kinds of other things that food has an impact upon. But what was your experience with food growing up, not just, raising it, but also your diet?
Well, I come from a family legacy of 400 years. We traced my family roots back 400 years farming, which is quite a long time of continuous farming. And I grew up on a farm, small farm, right on the border of Rockville and Bethesda, Maryland. And we grew about 95% of the food that we ate. So it was really has always been a part of my life to eat good food and also to pass it on to others. We always grew more food than we could eat or sell. So we always shared that food with family and extended family and friends. So it's always been a part of my life. So at an early age, I realized how important good food really is because of the taste of the food. And I like to eat, and I I grew quite large at an early age, so so you're always hungry, you know. So, but food has always been a very powerful thing in our family. The fact that we didn't have a lot of spendable income, but having food was such a powerful thing.
So what sort of things did you eat on the farm there in Maryland?
Well, we ate just about everything. From my father was an avid outdoorsman, fisherman, hunter. So we ate a lot of wild things like squirrels and rabbits.
Oh, really?
And things like that.
Much harder to find in Rockville, Maryland today.
Yeah, we used to go to Potomac River during the herring run and dip herring. And salt them down. We used to go to the slaughterhouses and get our meat and salt it down or process it ourselves. And we used to grow a few hogs, and we had chickens and so forth. So we always had lots of good food, something that I think a lot of people didn't have, because I think part of the problem that we have today is the fact that that legacy of farming, everybody in America, at some point in time, their family was involved in farming. But as we look back several generations, we see where it stopped, and that's when the problem started. We started eating food that wasn't good for humans to consume, and we have this terrible problem today where we only have about 3% of really good food in this country. We're eating food, but it's not necessarily good food, and you can see the results in our health in terms of all the diseases and so forth. And I know talking to I work with a lot of medical folks, and talking to medical professionals, they believe that food is the number one killer of people, bad food. So the only way I believe that we can cure this problem is to grow healthy people. And the only way to do that is to grow healthy food. So that's the big elephant in the room. How do we get people growing healthy food again?
You also got, I imagine, a fair amount of exercise on that farm.
Yes. I mean, that's part of my ability to play, become a high school All-American and have 100 scholarship offers coming out of high school, was the fact that I was a big, strong farm boy, got a lot of exercise. So when people talk about farming, young people, I always try to tell them that, you know, this is probably the most exercise you'll ever get if you do some work.
Well,
some
playing basketball is pretty good workout,
pretty
too.
Good workout.
Yeah.
You talk in your book about how there is this change from 900,000 African-American farmers in 1920 to, I think it's 18,000 or something,
yes.
Just a bit later. And I also was struck in your book by the opening couple chapters where you start out with escape, looking at your mother leaving South Carolina,
yes,
to go to Washington, D.C., and then the second chapter called Return, where you suddenly find yourself going back to farming. Tell us about the sort of the migration and the loss that happened when so many African-American farmers left the South.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily been talked about enough that African-American folks, this legacy of farming through slavery, through Reconstruction and sharecropping is where my parents were both sharecroppers that came out of South Carolina. And sharecropping was maybe one step above slavery in my mind, and to escape from that was, I guess, a positive thing for folks. But unlike many African Americans that left the South in the 30s to come to northern states, whether they were from the East Coast, like South Carolina and North Carolina, and those states up to the East Coast, or whether they came from Mississippi, Arkansas, into the Midwest, many of those folks didn't want to farm again, didn't want to grow food again. But my father, for some reason, wanted myself and my brothers to learn about where our food came from, and for practical reasons, to grow our own food because we didn't have a lot of spendable income.
Now, if we're talking about the 1930s, there's still not a huge glut, I think, of processed foods in the city. So those former sharecroppers and their children who migrated north to urban areas, what were they eating?
Well, early on, I think people were eating pretty good food because many of them, I would say not the majority, were actually growing some of their own food in the backyard. It was kind of a hidden thing, a thing where people were ashamed to be seen growing food. And I still see that today amongst some of the older folks. They are ashamed of the fact that they are actually growing food.
Because they see it as a sort of class or caste thing, as if
I think it's around the issue of slavery and mm-hmm. sharecropping and so forth.
Even farming, to some extent, was by some people was kind of looked down upon as being, you know, you don't have to be smart to be a farmer. Was the idea is just something you kind of did out of default. But the victory gardens of World War II helped to turn that around a little bit. I guess there were some 20 million of those.
Yeah, I think that was the Victory Gardens pretty much affected a lot of the population during the war, where you had to grow your own food. You had to be able to if you weren't going to survive. But once that was over, then we went back to this system where we only have a few states that are growing the majority of our food and shipping. When transportation system became more diverse and so forth, that all changed, and that's what we're dealing with today.
Well, agribusiness? Mm-hmm.
Yes, and large farms. Like I said, back in the 20s, we had 900,000 African-American farmers. About 20% of the farmers in America were black farmers. Today, less than 1%. When you look at the state of Wisconsin, it's just a handful of us in the state of Wisconsin. The last time I looked at the statistics in a state like Arkansas, I think there were 90 African-American farmers.
90.
When you think about that.
State.
In the whole state. So we have a long way to go, and I think with the recent situation with our health and people really, since I really look at the First Lady has done a tremendous job in terms of when she put that garden on a White House lawn, it's estimated that 10 million people started growing food.
Wow. And so much emphasis on exercise as well.
Yeah. And that's a long tradition, too. I mean, as late as, what, 1910 or so, there were milk cows grazing on the White House lawn. Hard to imagine today.
Right.
but some of that seems to be coming back.
Yeah, and I think when I helped her launch the Let's Move campaign, I think, and I told her that, and I think she was surprised at that. How big of an effect she had, the symbolism of this 1,200 square foot garden had such positive results. And many of those people were African American folks who, when I started doing this work in Milwaukee 20 years ago, people used to say to me, why are you doing the slaves' work?
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
I go through communities. But I don't hear that today.
Yeah, well, you've turned a concept into a huge success and gotten lots of recognition for it. I noticed that one of the reviewers of your book wrote that Will Allen's life proves that success often grows from failure. And you write very honestly and openly throughout the book about various false moves or wrong turns or, you know, different things that sort of went wrong. Can you talk about that a little bit, about the sort of life lessons that you can draw from your story of going from where you began to where you are now?
Yeah, I think when I look at my career, it goes back to my biggest influence, of course, were my parents, who made sure that we understood where our food came from and we produced our own food. But also the experiences I had playing team sports, of how to work together as a family unit, as a community unit, to bring people together. So I think, you know, one of my strengths, you know, I always try to, and I tell people that work for me and people I've met, is try to leverage your strengths. Figure out what your strengths are and really leverage your strengths. And one of my strengths was to bring people together to work together and take a leadership role in that and do something that's concrete that people can see, because talk is cheap.
Yeah.
We can always say we're going to do something and never do it.
No, just have meetings and more meetings about it.
Yeah, and we can come up with brochures and schematics of things that could be, but never get actualized. So for me, that's where it's at, is to not just waste so much time. We have to do planning, but it doesn't take a lot of planning to grow a garden, to get something started. It may not be perfect. So over the years, I've made mistakes, but the whole thing about farming or anything, I guess, any profession, is the people that are really successful are passionate about what they do. And I think to be a farmer, you have to be especially passionate, because I think I've had a lot of jobs. Worked in corporate America, played professional basketball, had all kinds of jobs, you know, in my life growing up. But I think farming, becoming a sustainable farmer, growing good food, is probably the most challenging thing one can do. And sustain yourself and your health, and to be able to do that over a long period of time. And scale it up so it changes the dynamics of your family or your community or whatever, because that's what I'm all about, is to really try to change the dynamics in a positive way of a community through food, which I think is the most important thing in our lives.
Well, you mentioned Michelle Obama as a role model for these 10 million gardeners.
Yeah.
Did you ever think of yourself as a role model when you were an athlete or later?
Well, I always took a leadership role, but I didn't necessarily think of myself as a role model. I think we started using this role model thing recently with athletes who were doing some not-so-good things.
Sure.
And we talked about
it. Yeah, it's a really mixed bag.
I was just so into doing my work, spending so much time, because as a farmer, and you can talk to whether you're a dairy farmer, which I think dairy farmers work harder than anybody, but you don't have a lot of time to sometimes think about yourself. You're thinking about your animals or whatever you're producing. You're trying to figure out, how do I get this food to market? How do I get the prices that I want? There's so much thought going into problem solving every day that you don't have time to think about your own personal life and things that are happening.
And coping with the weather as well.
Yeah,
which is,
and the weather and all the challenge. I mean, there's so many challenges, whether you're growing inside or outside. You know, the wind can take down greenhouses, if you're growing in greenhouses or hoop houses, if you're growing outside, all bets are off.
Floods, especially, especially these days.
These days. And how did you go from having jobs in corporate America with Procter & Gamble, Kentucky Fried Chicken, and so on, to this decision that you made at one point to buy land and these sort of deserted greenhouses and actually start something?
Well, when I came back from Europe and Belgium, I was actually farming over in Belgium. One of my teammates' family had a farm, and I helped them, and that's when I really realized that I loved doing this. And then I got 25 chickens over there, and I started growing food. And because Belgium's such a small country, I knew all the other American players on the other team. So we were there because basketball season's during the fall and winter. So we were stuck over there during the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas. And I used to invite those players to our house where I would serve them the food that we grew. So we'd have this American meal at Thanksgiving and Christmas. So that's when I started. So I had this burning desire when I retired, when I left Europe, to farm. But because of the cost of land here in Wisconsin, I had to have an outside job. So I kind of had two full-time jobs. And in 1993, I was driving actually to one of my Procter & Gamble accounts along Silver Spring Drive, and I saw a for sale sign for this old nursery. And come to find out, it was the last registered farm in the city of Milwaukee. And the city owned it, and they had repossessed it for taxes. At that time, many of the greenhouse operations were going out of my and Pa's greenhouses were going out of business. Sure. Because, you know, all the Walmarts and Kmarts and were taking over the business, you know, selling bedding plants and so forth. So it was hard to for folks to maintain their businesses. So that was an opportunity, and I somehow tricked a bank into giving me a mortgage.
How big a farm are we talking about in the city of Milwaukee?
Well, we're only talking 3 acres. But it had a greenhouse and a retail space that I could turn into a retail store in a what's called a food desert area. The closest retail grocery store is 4 miles away, so the people very densely populated in that area. The largest public housing project was located there. So I looked at it as an opportunity for me to grow some food and distribute food and hire some youth from the community to work on the farm. So that's how I kind of got sucked into the nonprofit piece, because my friend said, well, since you like training, working with these kids, why don't you start a nonprofit? So at first it was a for-profit.
Mm-hmm. And how does that work with, I mean, you decide to buy a farm, even if it's, you know, 3 acres, in terms of selling it, how do you actually get, I mean, licensed to sell? Is there any kind of oversight in terms of your product?
Well, because it was a registered farm, I could pretty much sell anything off the farm, on the farm. So being on a busy highway like that, it was just a natural thing. As we started to grow, of course, we had to get a retail seller's license and so forth, just like any other business. But it's almost like having a farm stand that you probably see in a rural community.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. On the side of the road, you know.
Right.
Why not in the city?
Sure. So this would be a truck farm then?
Yeah, but we're not trucking.
We're selling
everything right there. You know, that's the cool thing about urban agriculture. You're taking out the transportation. You're taking out the transportation cost that many farmers, you know, have to deal with, you know. So
are you making a case then that there should be these farms, 2-3 acre farms, almost like parks, almost like you would do with urban parks where you feel you need a certain amount of green space just for recreation? You would advocate a certain amount of green space for raising healthy food in urban areas.
Yeah, I mean, I've been advocating for that for many, many years, because it just doesn't make sense for folks to be eating food that's grown, say, in California or Arizona or Texas or Florida, the big egg states that grow vegetables, and having them shipped in when we know that food has to travel many miles and it loses a lot of its nutritional value. And that's been quantified by some. Some people say it doesn't, but I think a lot of us that are in the business know that in the sustainable egg business know that it loses its nutritional value. So I think the only way for us to end world hunger in the world is to do it on a local or regional basis. I just don't see how we can do it, because that's failed. When we look at Africa and those countries where we've exported food to those countries, it hasn't ended hunger. We still have 5 million people dying from lack of food or water around the world each year. At no other time have we had a country with more obesity and all the diseases around heart disease and diabetes and high blood pressure and all those diseases that result from poor diet and lack of exercise.
Let's talk about poor diet. What do you think is poor diet? I know maybe these aren't connected at all, but you worked for Kentucky Fried Chicken for some period of time, and now you're advocating, you know, these healthy foods. So what's the relationship there?
Well, I think at that time when I came back from, I needed a job, and, you know, I worked for the Marcus Corporation, which owned the Kentucky Fried Chicken store. But if you all of a sudden, and I'm not an advocate to get rid of fast food places in communities, a lot of people concentrate, let's get rid of them all. Well, you're taking away thousands of jobs from people. You're taking away food from communities where grocery stores have pulled out. Remember, all these grocery stores that used to be in these low-income areas, especially people of color communities, have pulled out. The Kroger's of the world, all of those grocery stores, the Kohl's shut down in Milwaukee. So the only way for people to access food is through fast food, to survive in corner stores. But that's where a lot of our bad food is coming from. So the only way to get good food in there is to be proactive and start growing food in your back. The best case scenario is for folks to grow food in their backyards or side yards or front yards or whatever, on balconies or whatever percentage of their food. Many of these folks in these communities are trapped in these communities. They don't have transportation to go out to outside to say a Sam's or a Walmart or some of the large stores in the suburbs. I mean, I live in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Within a mile of my house, there's 5 grocery stores, full-service grocery stores. But these communities don't have that. So that's part of the problem that we have. And you look at cities that are locked down like Chicago, where you have to stay in your community because it's dangerous to go outside of your community, especially young people. So we have all these issues that probably not too many people really address. What are the root causes of poverty and that sort of thing? Because it's a much more complex issue than just thinking about food.
Right.
There's other things in terms of jobs. And I believe if we build a local food system, we can create thousands of jobs, because we've proved that in Growing Power, that we have over 100 employees. And it just started with me. So over the years, we can produce jobs and living wage jobs, which we should. You know, we don't look at what is the minimum wage. Do we want to pay people whatever it is? I don't even know what it is.
Well, we're talking $10.10 lately.
Yeah, where we start people at the lowest at $12 an hour. So, you know, I think that's where we have to be. We have to have a social conscience. And part of our work is really about food justice, social justice, environmental justice. So everything we do is wrapped around those justices that we're trying to make sure that everybody should have a right to good food. But the problem right now we have is the fact that we're not growing enough good food. So, I mean, that is the big problem, and that's what we try to address at Growing Power, is to train people to be able to grow food, grow good food. Because when I talk about food, I don't just say food, I say good food.
Good food. We're going to talk more about the good food revolution when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. A better food system won't heal everyone, But if we can take control of the food environment in our inner city communities, and if we can knit together the broken fabric between local farmers and our cities and repair the damaged urban land and grow fresh soil and food there, it can provide a chance for people to have lives with greater dignity. That's from the book The Good Food Revolution by our guest, Will Allen. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. You talk in your book, Will, about the importance of good soil. And I would think one of the problems with the concept of urban gardening, and urban gardening almost sounds like an oxymoron, like those terms don't go together, is how do you create healthy soil in areas that have been known to be a place of blight?
Well, it's all about the soil. I say that over and over again. If you don't have good soil, you're not going to be able to grow good food. That's where you get the taste of food, the nutritional value of the food that we're eating. It comes from food being grown in good soil. So we put a lot of emphasis on that. If I wasn't able to grow soil, I couldn't grow food. So inside of cities, if you look at what we have inside cities, about 50% of the available land, there's a lot of available land, especially in the Midwest. About 50% of that is asphalt and concrete. And, of course, there are a lot of rooftops. So to be able to grow on those surfaces, you have to be able to grow soil. So that's what I do. I grow soil.
Grow soil.
Is that where the worms come in?
Well, yes. I mean, we also inject worms into the soil because that's what gives you that living biological system that's sustainable, that keeps the fertility of the soil going, is the worms. So and, of course, in industrial agriculture, they use so many chemicals, it's dead soil that they're growing in. And I know all the results aren't out yet in terms of how much chemical uptake that those plants have. We know that if we grow food without chemicals, we have a good chance of living longer, and the taste of the food is just fantastic. I mean, that's where it's at. I think everybody likes food. I mean, you know, the taste of food changes the dynamics of if you're having a meeting, if you're a family meal. Food is something that is such a powerful thing. It brings people together if they eat a good meal. I mean, you could have people that have opposing views. Or you could bring a bunch of gang members together, sit them at a table and give them good food, and they forget about who they are. That's how powerful food really is, you know. And, of course, our health, the only way that we're going to end this health care crisis in this country, and I say this a lot lately, is to grow healthy people. That's the only way. We can come up with all kinds of formulas and all this political rhetoric. That's not going to take us anywhere. So we're going to have to grow healthy people.
So let's say I'm a healthy person, but I'm living in the heart of Milwaukee. And I'm seeing asphalt. I've got maybe a parking lot in my backyard. I've got, a roof with the sun beating down on it by day, and a flat roof in this case. Where do I begin? I mean, I can't just like start putting dirt on my roof and bring in worms. How do I get this whole thing to work? And of course, you have to water it too, which
right.
is a little tricky if you're on a rooftop.
And I get asked this question almost daily because people want to start. How do I start? Of course, it takes several months, call it 4 months at minimum, 8-9 months if you compost in a static state where you don't turn the compost to speed up the breakdown. So I tell people to go out and find some good compost, but also realize all compost isn't equal. As a matter of fact, most of the compost that's grown in this country is carbon-based compost that comes from carbonish materials like wood chip and leaves and stuff like that, paper. You can't really grow food in that. Good compost is the way that we do it is one part carbon, one part nitrogen. And, of course, the nitrogen inputs are animal waste, food waste, brewery waste, coffee grinds, things like that. So that's what we do. We rescue that food from the landfill and put one part carbon, one part nitrogen into piles or windrows and turn it. And 4 months later, you have soil that we can grow. So we put 2 feet of new soil on top of asphalt and concrete and rooftops, and you can grow almost any crop.
So you're bringing
on that
in
depth of 2 feet.
You're bringing in soil in addition to the compost? You're mixing it?
We're bringing in our compost. We only grow inside the city a compost that can grow food. Again, understanding that this compost is made up of carbon and nitrogen and not just carbon. So most of the compost in this country, as I travel the country, I see a lot of carbon-based compost that really doesn't get you there. So,
can we talk about the economics of the sort of food justice issue? You know, as you know, I do the Odyssey Project working with adults at the poverty level, and many of them are on food stamps.
Yes.
And I've had, like, a mother who will say, I'm going to switch from milk to Kool-Aid to save money.
Right.
Or, you know, and we know that it costs less to buy a Hostess Twinkie than to get organic vegetables.
Right.
How do you sort of link these problems together, the problem of poverty and then the problem of getting good food, when it costs so much more to eat in a healthy way?
Yeah. First of all, I think a lot of the so-called organic food is... I think those prices are inflated. They aren't really the real cost of the production of that food. It doesn't cost $3 to grow a tomato or $4 to grow a tomato, for heaven's sakes. It just doesn't. And I think by growing locally and growing in your backyard, and that's what we're hopefully can introduce to the Odyssey students and people all over, is that you can grow a percentage of your own food and save that way. Because when you look at, people always say, do you adjust your prices? Because our prices kind of mirror conventional prices. We don't try to use the same pricing structure as, say, organic food that's sold at these high-priced organic stores. And I won't mention any of them by name.
But I think we know them. Yes.
Because some of them are doing good stuff these days and supporting farmers and supporting our project as well. We really need to get people to grow more of their own food or access food through farmers markets. But the key thing is, like this Odyssey Project, I think it's important that we educate folks about good food. Because when you think of how much it costs for a pack of cigarettes or a carton of cigarettes, and we have this program called Market Basket where you can get 20 pounds of food for $16, enough to feed a family of four for a week with fruits and vegetables, that's a pretty good deal. Mm-hmm. That's much cheaper. And then there's that cost of, if you eat bad food, you're going to pay a much higher cost associated with your health. So I think it's the way that we have to educate people to make them understand that, hey, you're going to pay a pretty heavy toll, you know, because you may become obese, you may have high blood pressure, you may have all these illnesses that are just devastating. And I don't believe, I always talk to teachers about, because I was an education major in college, and I couldn't begin to educate a student unless they've had a good meal, a breakfast.
Sure, sure.
So it's the same thing with adults in the Odyssey program. If people are coming to class and they're hungry, they're going to be concentrating, you know, I'm hungry. They're not going to be listening or able to read or concentrate. So it's so important that as part of all these educational programs and that we add in some food systems stuff, some environmental issues around eating locally, supporting the local community, supporting those local farmers. And you said something earlier about this perception about farmers being like dumb people, you know, which is totally not true. I think farmers are some of the most creative people that we have. And for them to be successful and stay in the business, you have to be very smart. You have to be creative. You have to come up with ways. You have to change the way that you operate to stay in the game, to stay in the business. So,
do you think that's a lingering effect worldwide of this system, sort of a caste system, where there's the people who labor, the people who are growing the crops, and then there's this elite at the top that doesn't have to work, doesn't have to get all sweaty, has soft hands, you know, that we're still kind of feeling the effects of a hierarchy that we inherited.
Yeah, but it's also coming to bite us now. When you think about, look at California agriculture, which is totally unsustainable, where most of our fruits and vegetables come from springtime, early springtime, all the way to the weather gets cold, and then we switch to South America, right, or Central America, whatever. That California system is is starting to change because
running out of water for one thing.
Lack of water, lack of labor because of low wages and so forth. And people, every time a farm worker can find a higher paying job, they're going to leave farming. So that's one of the big issues that those farmers are having today. So all these wealthy people that want all this good food, it's going to, in the future, it's going to become a problem because we're not growing enough good food. Like I said, only about 3% of the food that we grow is organic. And so we're going to have to change the way we think. We're going to have to, those people that want that good food are going to have to participate in helping farmers in terms of helping to build infrastructure by, you know, passing on some of the dollars that they've made, because there are a lot of wealthy people in this country. Look what the stock market has done in the last couple of years. They're going to have to start sharing some of their wealth and helping to build a system if they want this good stuff. But it's got to be an equitable thing where they think about not only themselves, but the rest of the country. Because if we live in communities, even like Madison, if you have one section of Madison that's low income and struggling, it's going to affect everybody. You know, I always think about, you know, my kids and so forth. If you go into, say, a downtown area and you got people that are hungry and distressed and so forth, chances are that they might hurt you. You know, I mean, let's be realistic. But if we had a society where people had enough income and so forth, crime rates, it's been proven that crime rates are reduced when people have enough of things like food and jobs and so forth. So we're all in this together. So what I try to do is bring all of these pieces together, bring everybody to what I call the Good Food Revolution table. The universities, the corporate community, medical community, everybody needs to be at the table. It can't be like the old days where there were just folks studying, academics studying the food system and crusty old farmers like myself sitting at the table. We need everybody at the table to figure out how to build these food systems in these communities, because we're all in this thing together. We live in such a, the world has shrunk. More people are living in cities. More people are flocking to cities today. How are we going to feed 3.1 billion more people over the next 40 years? You know, we have to figure that. Some cities, we're going to have to build vertical farms to grow food, because there are some cities like New York and Boston and Vancouver and Tokyo and San Francisco where there's no horizontal land mass. So we're going to have to be able to grow food in buildings that are 50, 100 stories to feed ourselves. So that's what's going to have to happen. So a lot of my kind of stuff that I'm doing is really kind of looking into the future, kind of futuristic, looking at aquaponics, being able to take all these old buildings and be able to grow food inside buildings, reuse of old buildings instead of tearing them down, find a use for those buildings.
Are you working with Detroit at all?
Yeah, we have a regional training center in Detroit. We have 15 regional training centers around the U.S. that we work with those organizations and help build their infrastructures, their agricultural infrastructures. But it's not just, everybody looks at this as a urban issue. But as I travel the South, all these small towns that have been shut down because the industrial ag system has changed, those small towns are devastated, many of which are in Wisconsin. I get so many calls from small towns that want to start community gardens. It would be shocking to a lot of people to know that these small, small towns are hurting, where many of the people that were in the ag industry are now without jobs, but they're stuck in those towns, and where drugs are rampant, and same social issues that we deal with in big cities, we're dealing with in those small towns.
We're going to look further at the difference between good food and bad food and how you can raise good food and what the perhaps intangible advantages are, too, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Will Allen, the author of The Good Food Revolution and an advocate for healthy eating and for raising much of our own food, whether it's in an urban environment or somewhere else. Good food versus bad food, you know, it's kind of easy to say we're all for good food and we're against bad food. But can you make a distinction between, say, a potato that's good food versus a potato that's bad food and the distinctions that you're making?
Well, I mean, we have to quantify. That's part of a project that I'm working on, is to really quantify the nutritional value of and come up with some testing protocols. But it's all about the soil, where it's grown, where the food is grown in. But I think the thing that we'd like to do and get people aware of is to support the local economy by being able to buy as much local as they can. I know when you go into a grocery store today, if you want to buy something local, you probably spend a couple hours looking for local labels. So one of the things that we're doing at Growing Power is working with a couple Piggly Wiggly stores where they actually have a locally grown section that's labeled in big letters so you can walk right there and they have locally grown food. And that makes it much easier for the consumers to be able to shop and buy something that's local, that's probably a higher quality, that's closer. Because, again, if food travels many miles, it loses a lot of its nutritional value. And that's really where the rubber meets the road with our health, is the nutritional value of our food.
Does it get worse because you have to put preservatives on it? Is that the difference?
Well, I think the preservatives come in when it's processed, because most of us eat processed foods. When you think about a city like Milwaukee or Chicago or New York, where 99% of the food comes from 1,500 miles away or further, I mean, that's a problem. So that's how much we have to go. That's how far we really have to go. If we could change the dynamics, say 10%, if we can make 10% of the food local in communities, that's a huge change. When you think about 10% less trucks traveling our roads to bring food, and you think about the environmental impact, and you think about the job creation, just with 10% as a goal, and that's our goal at Growing Power, is to try to make sure that in Milwaukee we have 10% local food coming into the city of Milwaukee.
I was going to say that would be, I mean, I assume already is, a big ally of this grow local, buy local movement, and that is the whole environmental issue. Every now and then when the price of gas spikes, everybody says, oh, let's just start buying local. And that kind of goes away after a while.
Yeah, I think to make this happen, I think the most successful food system areas of the country have been supported by the politicos in those cities. Whether it's the county government or city government, they have to be totally involved. They have to have positions within the government that support locally grown food. And I think Milwaukee is a great example of that, where the policies to be able to grow in any zoning area, whether it's commercial, residential, or industrial, is a big thing to be. So we can have chickens in backyards and bees in people's backyards. I think those things, the city council pretty much supports everything that we bring before them in terms of the food that we're growing and so forth. I think that is going to be a key piece in terms of policy changes that have to be made with cities, because it's not going to happen just by it's going to take a lot longer if we don't have the city or county or state support.
So it seemed to be loosening up, but I seem to be hearing more often about people, you know, like in Fort Atkinson, for example, who keep chickens in their backyard. Is that something that's fairly recent on the upswing?
Well, I think it's growing. When you look at almost weekly, there's articles about locally grown food. New York Times has taken it upon themselves to really, Michael Pollan writes articles in the New York Times. The New York Times Magazine has different farms. They illustrate different farms around the country and so forth. You know, you see the national television, major stations have things on food. You see all the new chefs, all these young chefs.
They are really
pushing for healthy food and locally grown food. They go to farmers markets. I know I go to the Green City Market in Chicago, where 100 chefs come each week. And they'll come via a taxi, and they'll fill that taxi up with food and take it back to their restaurant. So this has happened in the last 10 years. 10, 12 years, things have totally changed.
And that's an exciting thing, all the farmers markets and the emphasis on good food. What do you find now would be your biggest frustrations? If you're looking out there and you see here are a bunch of obstacles still or things that are really, that keep you up at night wishing you could do something about it. Because I know you've said equal access to good food is a civil right.
Right. I think the biggest thing that's the biggest challenge right now is the lack of funding for sustainable agriculture. Our USDA food policies, our food bill that was just signed, farm bill that was just signed, isn't giving enough. There's still most of the money is in commodity crops. It's not in vegetable crops. So we have to continue to work on that. But it's going to take, I guess I get frustrated because a lot of people talk about it, but they don't go into action. I think we have to have more concrete examples of farms inside cities especially instead of just, you know, I wonder, we should have this farm on this vacant lot or whatever. You know, we need more people, but we need to grow more farmers. We don't have enough farmers to do this work. And you can't grow a farmer overnight. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks, oh, let's do a training program and we're going to have all these farmers. It doesn't work that way. Again, it's the most challenging thing to grow food and all the obstacles, and you're going to have to go through some pain and suffering. But we, you know, even though I would say 70% of the folks that want to be involved in the food system today are under 40 for the first time, a great sign. But out of those 70%, how many really want to farm?
Once they've been at it for a while.
Yeah, how many do they really want to farm? How many young people want to go out in the fall, like we did this year, to pull 500,000 pounds of carrots out of the ground in October when it's raining and it's 30 degrees. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the real test. But the good news is that they can participate in the food system in one way or the other, whether they're going to be consumers or whether they want to get into aquaponics inside buildings, which I think is the fastest growing piece of agriculture today, growing fish and plants in the same system, and that's something we train people to do. I think young people like doing that, developing renewable energy systems so that we can keep the cost down. There's so many different jobs. We could sit here and brainstorm hundreds of different jobs that are connected to the food system, which is the world's largest occupation. Food is the largest occupation in the world. We have to eat food to survive. So I think it has a promising future because I think this next generations are into it. But it's going to take time. It's not going to happen overnight.
Well, you were born into farming.
Yes.
Not all that many years ago, but some time ago. And so you, in a sense, didn't really choose to become a farmer. But looking back, and with your current experience too, for that matter, in terms of the intangible rewards of farming, the kind of satisfaction you get, the sense of self-reliance, is that really what, and perhaps just even the physical contact with the ground and with things that grow, is that really what's at the core of it?
Yeah, I think for me it is, because I do a lot of things in the food system, just like talking to you all today. But the thing that I enjoy most, because I get asked this question all the time, is actually growing food, being a farmer. Being able to put that seed in the ground and watch it grow and take care of it during that process, that it turns into a fruit or something that you pick from the farm. To see the joy on people's faces when you go through all of those steps of growing the soil and then planting the crop and maintaining the crop and harvesting the crop and processing the crop and getting it to market, to see people sit down and eat that food is a very satisfying thing for me. That's what turns me on more than anything else. I mean, I can do all these other things, you know, go around the country and talk about what I do and that sort of thing. But my real passion is to grow food and watch those plants grow and watch people eat that and have people call me and say, your food was great.
What's the calendar look like for an urban Wisconsin farmer?
The calendar for urban farmer is year-round for me and for many other farmers, to be able to grow food year-round. Because why are we just eating, when you think of CSAs and so forth, some of them only run 25 weeks out of 52 weeks. So why can't we eat this good food 365 days of the year. How do we build a system, a local system, to be able to produce food in this climate, this harsh climate, 365 days of the year? Well, we know how to do it. You know, we have to be able to figure out how to reduce the cost, how to use renewable energy to be able to reduce the production cost, to be able to grow food in the wintertime inside greenhouses and hoop houses, and to grow food inside vacant buildings using the latest and greatest lighting systems. How do we reduce the energy cost? How do we come up with the water? Because water is an issue. Even in a state like Wisconsin, where it looks like there's plenty of water, but there's regulations on water use, whether you're tapping into hydrants or wherever you're getting your water from. Water costs money, mm-hmm. You know. So how do we build systems like we have at Growing Power, where we capture 30,000 gallons of water off of our buildings and reuse it? So we have to come up with these innovative ways of reducing the cost of growing food.
Now, what about another very old-fashioned way of spreading food out over the calendar year, and that is pickling, preserving, canning?
Right. And that's another thing. As we start, one of our projects for this year is to build a commercial kitchen. That's a kitchen that multiple people can use and share the cost of operating a kitchen to preserve food and to freeze food and so forth. So that's something, an old art that pretty much has decreased a lot. And I hear more and more people wanting to do that today. But they have to learn how to do it. So that'll provide jobs. There are people in communities that know how to can, mm-hmm. that they can become the instructors to teach people in the communities. We need to utilize the talents we have. We have a lot of hidden talents in these communities. I think this Odyssey project is going to be one of the projects that you can be able to glean some of that, you know, once you find out that some of these folks have skills that they're afraid to maybe talk about. And as you get to know them, you know, and then maybe you can get them to pass on some of those skills to the other people that they get close to as they build their relationships. That, to me, that's what this is all about. It's about building relationships with everybody in the community. Once we start saying, I don't want to build a relationship with this group or this group, is when we get ourselves in trouble. Because like I said earlier, we need everybody at the table. It's not like the old days where we can kick people away from the table. I don't like the color of your hair. I don't like your religion or whatever. I don't like your corporate policies just based on something they've heard and not really knowing what this company's all about. Because when we look at these companies, if we go back to the Civil War days, I mean, most of the insurance companies, many of the insurance companies were involved in slavery. I don't hear anybody ever criticizing insurance companies, but they'll criticize a Walmart or some other corporate company. So everybody has some skeletons in their closet, you know, but we still need to work with those people. You know, as my cousin always says, well, we got to love them.
Well, that's a great note to end on.
Thank you for being at our table here at University of the Air. Our guest has been Will Allen. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year.